I'm going to give a review of the current thinking on core collapse theory. This is a pedigreed subject that's been around far too long. It's one of the major unsolved problems in astrophysics. Exactly how a massive star explodes to leave behind a neutron star or black hole, to litter the interstellar medium with the products of nucleosynthesis, to give us these incredible bursts of neutrinos, to energize the interstellar medium, to in fact do much of the heavy lifting in a broad range of astrophysics. The fact that it's unsolved shouldn't mean that people shouldn't try to address it in some detail. And so over the years there have been a variety of groups that have tried to apply various tools to the solution of this, what is in fact a very multidimensional, time-dependent problem. So what I'm going to do is not give you a general solution. I'm going to talk about some of the interesting little tidbits and facts that surround this problem and hint at a solution along the way. There are collaborators, of course, in this, in particular this endeavor, which is very computationally intensive. I list them at the bottom. There are more. Yvonne Hubeny, for example, is joining our group, and I'm going to be talking about some at the end of my talk, some of the things that we plan to do. But there are major collaborators, in particular Todd Thompson and Rolf Walder and Christian Ott, in some of these efforts, and I want to give them due credit. Again, the outline of this talk is going to be just that. It's going to outline the topic, but I'm going to talk about perhaps some of the effects of rotation, perhaps some of the effects of multidimensional effects, that would be convection in addition to rotation. I'll highlight some of the results from this code developed in collaboration with Ellie Livni and Itamar Lichtenstadt, Vulcan 2D, which is one of the most sophisticated such codes in astrophysics, but is not sophisticated enough, in my estimation, for delving in sufficient detail into this problem. But I'll show you some of the results with movies. A few of those movies are as hot off the presses, so some of the formats are a little bit off, and you'll see what I mean as we go through it. But I think you'll enjoy some of the things that are rendered. As part of this, I'm going to show some of the first calculations of the effect of rotation on the radiation field that emerges in neutrinos from this core object. So the anisotropy of the neutrino emissions and the heating. Generally, you do this problem in spherical symmetry. You can do that much more precisely in spherical symmetry. But in fact, as I say, there are instabilities and there's rotation, and so you really have to do it in the full multidimensional complexity and glory that nature has provided us. And so we're attempting to do that with these tools that have taken years to develop. Well, we'll show some of those results. It's also the case that when you have something that's aspherical, where you have a time-changing quadrupole moment, lots of mass moving very fast, you're going to get gravitational radiation. And while gravitational radiation has never been directly detected, there are a variety of attempts that are emerging with LIGO, for example, LISA in the future, TAMA, GEO-600, etc., to do just that, detect gravitational radiation directly. What we're doing is providing predicted signatures in gravitational radiation and ideas about what information can be gleaned if LIGO, in fact, detects one from the solar neighborhood or in the environment of the galaxy. I'm going to finish with a discussion of some of the developments that we're involved with now. This has not really borne fruit, but the scheme itself is so sweet I just wanted to show you. But I'll just give you a pastiche of some of the basic ideas in this subject. Of course, one of the most important things that people are interested in is nucleosynthesis going up a network, where this is Z versus N, and this is just for art purposes. When you get to high temperatures and densities, you go from lighter light species to heavy species, and in the supernova context, a shock wave is formed. That shock wave goes down the density gradient and heats material sufficiently to convert oxygen and silicon, for example, to nickel-56. And nickel-56 is the progenitor for most of the iron around us, decaying to cobalt and decaying to iron. And its origin is a supernova of this type, the core collapse type, or the type 1a type. Of course, in the context in which we do this is a massive star evolution. And just in case people aren't familiar with the basic background, you'll start with a star maybe greater than 8 solar masses. It will evolve to the point where it will expand its outer envelope and contract its inner zones, and contract those latter zones sufficiently that you will actually achieve a white dwarf in the center with densities that are millions of times the densities of terrestrial material. There are many white dwarfs in the universe, but these white dwarfs are rather exotic. They are the progenitors of the core collapse supernovae because they achieve the so-called Chandrasekhar mass, become gravitationally unstable, and convert from a white dwarf into a neutron star within about a second, achieving nuclear densities, and upon doing so, compressing. You get to very high densities where the material stiffens. It bounces after that dynamical phase, and you get a spherical shockwave. That spherical shockwave should be the supernova in its infancy, but what the problem has been is that with good physics in there, the shock dies. Now, we can actually revive the shock, and we know how, with the neutrino mechanism, heating the material behind the shock. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but we haven't proven this. There are ideas, for example, that are being brooded about the magnetic fields, in fact, and MHD jets, such as you see in AGN, and quasars might actually be important agencies. I don't think that's the case. I think that's the case in maybe 1% or a few% of the time, and that gives you so-called hypernovae or gamma ray bursts. But in the garden variety case, where more than 90% of core collapses reside, I think it's actually driven by neutrinos, but we have yet to prove that, and you should keep that in mind. And so all this is showing is the star in the center collapses in, the outer star expands, and what we're talking about is this inner region where all the action is. People have seen this before, but this is, for example, an evolutionary diagram for the progenitor of 1987A, the supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud. You have luminosity here increasing along the y-axis and surface temperature, and a star might be born over here in this region of luminosity space and then move to the red. This is the lower temperatures in the astronomical way of doing this, or the perverse astronomical way of doing this. You have low temperatures on the right-hand side. To the red and then going to the blue, and generally you bounce back and forth here. This object exploded in the blue, but this is the first 10 million years or so of the evolution of a massive star. And when it dies in a second. So it's quite a profound change in the evolutionary time scale, where the star took many millions of years to get to its death. And when it does, it dies, the core dies within seconds. The supernova is determined. The shockwave moves out through the envelope in hours to days and leaves behind these exotic objects, mostly neutron stars, sometimes black holes, probably neutron stars most of the time. And this is just the basic scenario. This is not to scale, but we'll have a progenitor in the so-called onion skin structure, where this core, which is where all the action is in the very center, and then it's surrounded by progressively lower atomic weight shells until you get to helium and hydrogen. It's the higher atomic weight shells that have been produced in the quiescent burning stages that preceded this, in that inner region, which is most germane to the explosion. That region right there can be telescoped out to this iron core, which collapses, as I say, it's about 1.5 solar masses, quite dramatically in a second or less. It gets to nuclear densities, and you get this bounce, as I say, and the shockwave stalls around there. In principle, it will continue out, and it'll leave behind this hot protoneutron star, which is radiating neutrinos copiously. The neutrino burst in this early phases is within an order of magnitude of the total optical output of the observable universe. It's very, very bright, but it's in neutrinos, and so it's hard to see. And even though there's a supernova second in the universe, there we've seen only one neutrino burst, and that was from 87A, and that was unambiguous in two detectors, one under near Lake Michigan, one in Japan. So the evolution I'm going to be talking about is basically this. It's going to be the collapse, the bounce at nuclear densities, the neutrino emissions, but with the convection and rotation included. Now, there's a lot that's missing from these calculations. I'll say that from the start. One thing is it's not general relativistic, and nature is. So I'm prepared to accept that. The code is as yet to get up to speed on that, though. It's a difficult problem to do. General relativity, even without any matter in there, just pure space-time, has never really been solved in all its generality. Black hole collisions, of just letting a black hole move along a grid. People haven't done that properly. They can do that for 1,000 light travel times, and then it blows up numerically. So there's a lot to do. We have to put in matter, we have to put in neutrinos, and we have to do the neutrinos in 3D transport. That makes it a seven-dimensional general relativistic problem. Time, the angles, energy group, three spatial dimensions. So we have our work cut out for us. Now, I'm going to put this in the context of the general paradigm, which is, this is just the radius, the object has collapsed and bounced as a shock. Behind the shock, there is heating by neutrinos. And so if this number is positive, just look at the solid line. If this number is positive, there's net energy deposition behind the shock. If this number is negative, it's cooling. You get an explosion if this is high and this is not so deep. In order to know exactly how this goes, you have to do good transport. You can't just do simple diffusion. And so that's part of the art, trying to do the good transport. And we're making progress along that direction. Now, if this is a little bit higher, just by 20%, if I don't change that, this explodes. So you see things are fairly close. If this is much lower and you don't lose down here, it also explodes. So there's some art involved. But when we put in our best art, in spherical symmetry, it does not explode.
Adam, it's a good time to ask a question that actually isn't out of left field. Center left. Suppose you have a mechanism that instead of giving you those different curves for new E, new bar E, that for some reason all the spectra are the same and the outer parts of the star and emergent. Will that make a significant difference to the explosion dynamics?
Well, if the spectra are harder, higher average energies, then the energy deposition is higher, the cross section is going with the increasing energy, and you can easily get it to explode if you increase the energies by, say, 20%.
Well, I was going to mix up the flavors.
Yeah.
The effect that increases the energy.
Right. What you're alluding to is the fact
of the more potent species.
Right. I didn't want to get too far afield on that. Maybe we can return to that at the end of the talk. But it's possible if the spectra are different and you have significant oscillation from the mu type to the electron type. But in fact, since the electron type is much more coupled to this material, you can enhance this sufficiently to get explosions. I don't think that's a solution, but I think it's certainly worthy of the investigation. I put this here because, again, if I change these numbers by just a small amount, let's say 25%, that's not 1%, that's 25%, then I can get explosions. And we've gotten that in some calculations that I'll show a little bit later with Todd Thompson and Elliot Quatter, where we put in deposition due to viscous dissipation, which hadn't been included before, but we included it in with an algorithm that isn't necessarily true, but we see exactly what's going on. Anyway, I'll get back to that later. This is just the context I'm talking about. The shock is sitting here, it's multidimensional, there's convection behind there, there's cooling in this inner region, remember that trough in the previous transparency, and there's heating out here. So the general heating is in the gain region where there's net energy deposition. Notice there's neutrino losses here, there's mass accretion, but it's sort of a steady state, like a CV, accreting CV, a cataclysmic variable. This heating region, you can show, surrounds this cooling region, and the cooling is quite significant. Then you get to the point at the neutrino sphere where they're all in balance again. That heating region is also convectively unstable. It's like heating water on a stove. You're heating from below, and you basically would generate a negative entropy gradient, just like in the atmosphere of the Earth, and under those circumstances, you can actually generate convection. And so what you get is a convective region that's also heating. Now, what's the virtue of the convection? In 1D, as I said, it doesn't explode. In 2D, one of the reasons is that you get accretion through the material. You get accretion through the shock, then it heats, then it cools, but it gets into the cooling region too quickly. If you can keep the matter in this heating region longer, you can get higher average entropies, and you can increase the efficiency of energy deposition. And what we see is in 1D, it doesn't explode. In 2D, it's marginal. In 3D, it may be less marginal. And when you put all of the physics in, my feeling is, in fact, with maybe a little bit of stuff that we're not quite understanding yet, that these things easily explode by the neutrino mechanism. So the multidimensional effects are useful because you have this advection time through this region, and if that advection time is long because of the multidimensional motion, it retards the sinking of this material. Compared to the heating time, then you can get explosion. Multidimensional convection naturally gives you this, and that's what this says here. The advection time is larger in the multidimensional case. We just have to demonstrate that. But see what tools we have to bring to bear. We have to have a good nuclear equation of state. We have to have multidimensional transport, multi-angle, multi-group, although much of what I'm going to show here is multi-energy group. We're doing the spectrum, but we're doing multi-group flux-limited diffusion. that's faster. But we can do the full angle calculation as well. It's just very much slower. We have to do it generally, general relativistically. We have multiple neutrino species. So there's a lot of particle physics, nuclear physics, statistical physics, gravitational physics, the numerical art thrown together. That's why the problem is difficult, but that's also why the problem is so intriguing. And so I just want to summarize a few things. Don't look at this in detail. I just want to direct your attention to a few of the salient points. The neutrino-driven explosion is not a 1% phenomenon, despite what it might have seen. It's not just that on the edge. It's a 10% phenomenon or so. It's not a factor of 2 off. So it's a 10% phenomenon. It's not the case that you have 10 to the 53 ergs of energy coming out. And the supernova, as you may know, has 10 to the 51 ergs of explosion energy. And you take that ratio, and that's 1%. It's that there's a few times 10 to the 52 ergs coming out when it could possibly explode in the early stages. And the energy deposition is in a shallower part of the gravitational potential well. It's not deep inside. You're going to leave behind your problems. One man's problem for the explosion is another man's pulsar theory, pulsar neutron stars, this sort of thing. You're going to leave behind that neutron star and all that binding energy. So that's okay. So it's a 10% phenomenon. Okay. It's also the case of the delay. The fact that the shock did not continue out is good. Because if it did, in fact, the material behind this shock generically is very neutron rich. And that's inconsistent with the nucleosynthesis. We don't see a lot of neutron rich material around us. We're made up of hydrogen and oxygen and carbon, etc. Oxygen has an electron to neutron plus proton ratio is 0.5. That's normal material. I'm talking about stuff that's 0.1. 0.2, 0.3. You don't want to eject a lot of that stuff, and you would have ejected tenths of solar masses per event had you ejected that. The other thing is, you also don't produce the neutron star masses that are seen. You explode immediately, you leave behind a puny neutron star that might have 1.1 solar masses. We observe neutron stars with 1.35 solar mass, 1.32, 1.28, 1.44 solar masses gravitational. That gravitational is an important thing. These are the way you may be used to thinking about these is baryonic mass. You add up all the baryons and you find out how much mass energy there is. But you're radiating, as I referred to before, 10 to the 53 ergs or 3 tenths to the 53 ergs. That's a lot of mass energy. That's a tenth of the solar mass.
Well, what about the observational consequence of being a very neutron-rich junk?
Observational?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how neutron-rich and how much junk. But if it's that much, if it exploded immediately, it would be immediately obvious that it's not our universe. We just don't have that neutron-rich. We have a small amount of neutron-rich material, small amount of...
But it wouldn't be bound out there. It would just do whatever...
It would mix in the interstellar medium and become part of the next generation of stars. And then subsequently, and it would pollute its entire world, the universe. So we don't see that.
In the very earliest stars you can observe, you get patterns that are very much solar.
So surprisingly.
Stars, yeah. You don't see very neutron-rich material.
Yeah, even in exotic cases.
I just wonder what the abundance of the elements would look like.
That can be calculated, but it depends on what you're putting in here. One thing, you're off, again, this is an aside, but for example, the stuff that I would eject here might have an electron fraction of not 0.5, but 0.35. If you ejected 0.48 material, which is very close to 0.5, let's say an 87A, you'd overproduce things like yttrium, zirconium, this sort of thing by a factor of 100. So this is nowhere near. In fact, with 87A, we see nickel, as I said, nickel 56. We also see nickel 57. And that 57 to 56 ratio was measured. And that measurement indicates that it was within about 50% of the solar ratio, but importantly, the simple nucleosynthetic calculations indicate that YE, that electron fraction, which would be 0.5 in U if you didn't have any hydrogen, approximately, can't be lower than 0.495 or 497. So there's tight tolerances here. We can't eject too much of this stuff.
I just remember this generation talk by George Fuller where he said because of neutrino this and that, you would never get enough neutrons out there for even the arc process.
Well, I'm not talking about the arc process here.
No, I know, but the question is how you get the
arc process?
How you get enough neutron-rich stuff out there. His problem was always you couldn't get enough.
Maybe we can address that later.
Therefore, we would make complicated scenarios with neutrino mixing, so this is sort of upside down here for a minute for me.
Well, we can't, in the normal case, eject too much neutron-rich material. And too much means hundreds, thousands of a solar mass. and this would be way above that. And where you get the R process and what neutron-rich material we do see, in particular the R process, is an open question. It might be in a supernova context or a fraction of the supernova context, but we really don't know. There are some hints from a number of things that it is in a context like this, but it can't be too much material. It has to be a small fraction. But let me continue. The other thing is that radiation pressure is not important. In many other contexts in astrophysics, the pressure of radiation, for example, stellar winds, is important, but in this context, it's a small effect. So it's really heating. Okay. Let's see if I... Well, these are just interesting things. Rotation, magnetic fields, viscous heating. There's an interesting also effect of vertical acoustic instability, which I might touch on. But these are just topics along the way to give you some of the basics I want to emphasize. Let me just say what rotation might do. I don't think that rotation necessarily is crucial, but it's always there. And important in this context, you start out with an object, it might be rotating slowly, but collapse will always amplify that rotation. And so the contribution of rotation will always be more important after collapse than before. You might be rotating slowly. And so what is the consequence of this? The reason I have a long list here is that we haven't, until the last year or two, been able to simulate with sufficient fidelity rotating models. Now, we don't know what the initial rotation rates are. So we're exploring the parameter space occupied by potential rotational profiles. And we want to see what the consequences are. And some of what I'm going to show you will no doubt be wrong, but it will be extreme. And so I include it. Now, one of the possible positive things of rotation is it provides centrifugal support, so the effect of gravity is smaller. Effect of gravity is smaller. You're fighting against gravity in this explosion. If you can lower gravity and keep everything else the same, which you generally can't, but something like that. But with the centrifugal support, then you make it easier to explode, and we see that. It also, because of the lower the centrifugal support, it makes that gain region larger, because that stuff that was there at small radius can be a little bit larger radius. It all goes in the right direction. In the extreme cases, you can generate funnels, where you have rotation and you actually get centrifugal barriers along the axis. And matter, after a while, can't accrete along the poles. And you can get bipolar explosions of substance. Now, that might be the extreme case, and I'll show a couple of examples of that very quickly. So, another context in which rotation, and one of the reasons I think rotation might be interesting, and this is 87A. And if you're watching closely, this is a movie. Whoops. If I'm watching closely. Oh, there. It is a movie. And this is 87A over 10 years. Look, the focus was on this ring of stuff lighting up. It's good. I hope it's running. If it's not running, I can't really tell. Yeah. Let me do it this way. Out of phase someplace. Here we go. Okay. The focus was on this, but look at this inner region. What shape do you think that is? In which direction do you think it's moving? That's the blast. And you see it has an axis, and that axis is roughly aligned with the ring. This is in projection, of course. To my mind, and it's not proven, of course, to my mind, this is a large-angle bipolar explosion. Doesn't have to be, but it looks like it. I'm not going to go through the movie again. It's not spherical, though. So, the types of models that we can put together include rotation. This is just a still showing you a structure. Well, these surfaces are isodensity surfaces, just to give you a sense of the nesting in these calculations. Those vectors are just velocity vectors for a particular calculation. But there's that funnel structure, which is achieved when you have really rapid rotation. And so these are the types of things we're going to be looking at. And the types of results look something like this. This is the extreme case. Don't worry, I haven't started the movie yet. Something like this. With the extreme cases, you get structure like this, where you get centrifugal bounces. You get a big shock that went off, which you didn't see because of the map. This is in electron fraction. And then you get material that is ejected along the poles, pulsating. Now, this is with really rapid rotation, which is probably almost a set of measure zero. Mm-hmm. But it might be something like the context in which hypernovae are produced, or gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts may have black holes in the center here, but you get a nice collimation of material that follows. So this is the type of thing we can simulate or are trying to simulate. Now, you can have less rapid rotation. This happens to be for a different progenitor mass and a little bit slower rotation. But this is one for which that first initial explosion, we didn't explode and it stalls. But watch the structure that's produced. There's a shock wave. It's a nice structure there, and you produce a torus. And we're trying to do transport in this context that's time dependent. So this is the type of thing that we want to look at. And a torus, of course, is an exotic structure. And importantly, when you get a torus form, it's possibly unstable in three dimensions, which we can't simulate at this stage. People have been able to do the simulations of this in three dimensions, but without transport.
Adam, you say you don't include general relativity, but do you include special relativity?
No. There's a lot of stuff. You can't include special relativity and ignore general relativity because they're in the same order at the higher order. So you ask the question whether you include terms of order V over C or not. And the new generation code is going to include that in 2D.
Okay, but you can get jets punching out of here with no Kelvin-Helmholtz instability.
Right, it's just the fun of the structure. Yeah, it's just because it's at the path of least resistance.
Along the same lines, what would the tangential velocity of the matter be at the neutrino sphere, say, in one of these things?
At the neutrino sphere?
Yeah.
Pretty small.
And
it accelerate out from the surface. So,
Beta.
Oh, no, near the neutrino sphere, it's very, very, it's 0.00001. But it's accelerating off the surface, yeah.
But the mechanism producing jets here
is neutrino driven.
It's completely different from what I hear advertised for, say, active
collection. Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. And it's very possible that when this is important, neutrino driven and with the centrifugal effects, that MHD processes are also important, which are not included here. And I think that's likely, in fact. But this is the type of the character thing when you push the numbers and what are possible. And you can get that type of structure, which is my point, even without magnetic fields. It's actually the same thing was in John Hawley's thesis, if you want to look at this, for SS-433. Anyway, this is an example of a calculation. I want to go back to the 1D stuff and the viscosity to which I referred. It was performed by Todd Thompson and collaborators. This is just radius versus time, where this is 0.1 second, 0.2 seconds, 0.3 seconds after bounce at zero. So you had a collapsing zone, it bounced and settled on the neutron star, bifurcated, exploded. And there's the shock wave there, but there's the matter zone. And the only difference here was we had a little bit of extra energy deposition due to viscous heating. And the viscous heating was due to an MRI, a magnetorotational instability. And we tried to do these calculations in 1D with the rotation in there, so it was really thick. But we tried to put in the centrifugal support and the heating due to the viscous heating on small scales. And all that was required, using standard parameters that are useful for MRI in an accretion disk, a little bit high, but on average, and a reasonably rapid initial rotational period, all it required was these numbers, and when we did the number calculations, if the MRI obtained, using the standard prescriptions associated with the heating that's a function of the differential motion, we got an explosion. And we got a whole range of explosions, so it was interesting. Now there's another thing, is these are calculations from Blondin et al. These are purely hydro, no neutrinos, and you can see they freeze the inner core, so it's just a hydro simulation. But what they do when they include the full 360 in 3D is they find this oscillating mode. So, and they're interpreting this as the so-called vertical acoustic instability of Foglitzo. I'm not going to go into any details, but it seems like it's possible for such structures to be unstable to these L equals 1 modes. And it's also possible that that is connected with kicks, pulsar kicks. Pulsars are observed to be the fastest population in the universe, relative. And with average velocities that, depending on your electron density model for the galaxy, is on the order of 400, 500 kilometers a second. Some are at escape, a large fraction might be at escape velocity. And so this is the type of thing we can simulate as well, just on pure hydro, and nice 3D stuff. But there's no physics in here. And so with the neutrinos, what happens? And we're starting to get a sense of that. So I wanted to give credit where credit was due, and then move on. What I'm going to show you here, again, I'm giving you a potpourri of results. There's no final conclusion here, but it gives you a sense of the richness of the problem. What happens, for example, if you have an initial perturbation in the otherwise spherical Chandrasekhar core? the density on the top is a little bit lower than the density at the bottom, or vice versa. And so we just do collapse with that asymmetry. This is just the inner region. You see the velocity vectors, but watch what happens. The core bounces around. You get these types of funnel structures. This was actually the first calculation in all of supernova theory, certainly, in which that core was allowed to move up and down before it was actually fixed, and we weren't able to do this. But in cylindrical symmetry with these types of codes, you can do this. Anyway, this shows you some of the things that are possible. So this brings me to the basic code that we're using now. It's going to be superseded, hopefully, in the future by better technology. But this just describes the basics of the code. And these are for the, this is for the cognoscenti who are interested in hydrodynamic lore, or radiation hydrodynamic lore. Vulcan 2D is a multi-group. That means it does the spectrum. Multi-angle does the phase space. Time-dependent Boltzmann hydro code in solving the problem in 6D. 7D would be, again, three-dimensional. It's an arbitrary Eulerian Lagrangian code. It has remapping in it. Again, these are just jargon, so I'll go quickly through this. Instead of doing three-dimensional hydro, again, it does six-dimensional radiation hydro. It has the possibility of a moving mesh. We use angles with the SN method for angular tiling and 150 angles over the sphere, the 4 pi square radians. There's one symmetry in that in 2D. Axis symmetric. It can include rotation. It's automatically flux conservative and it has a smooth matching of the diffusion limit. But its major Achilles heel is it does not have the velocity dependent terms. That's the Doppler and aberration effects. It's not so bad because these are continuum opacities. But there are terms that are missing, and our next generation hopefully will include all this.
Adam, do you see a lot of ray structures from your SN transport?
No. The rays are a standard thing in SN, but they start, given the number of rays that we have in here, they start at 400 or 500 kilometers. And that's interior to the shock.
Okay.
So when it's important, we don't get the rays. But it's because of those rays that Los Alamos people generally don't want to use it anymore. And I've talked extensively with a few who are disgusted by use of SN. But this is a standard technique. And maybe Yvonne wants to say let's see. Lots of little details here. We do have an implicit version, an implicit hydro version to the code, but it hasn't been hasn't gone through a shakedown cruise. For papers, you can refer to Libby et al., Walder et al., and there's a new paper that we're going to be finishing in the next couple of months on the mechanism. But I don't want to say too much on that right now. The basic parallelization algorithm, again, this is for people interested in numerics, is that we parallelize, it's MPI, we parallelize in energy groups. So each energy group is on a single processor, and the entire processor does all the hydro. So it's done redundantly. We do the hydro over and over again on each processor, but because transport is so slow, we speed up things by doing the hydro redundantly on all the processors. And so this is almost perfectly parallel. Okay. Whoops. This just shows the same sort of thing. So I'm going to go through this as quickly as I can. Just some basic results. Look at this in the context of the fact that these are the first such results ever achieved in supernova theory. In fact, I don't know if somebody will comment, but it's all of astrophysics. You haven't had a code that can do this time-dependent multi-group, etc. Although many people are working on parts of that. And if you actually look at the combination of capabilities, this is unique in that regard. This is a rapidly rotating one, and this is just after bounce. Here's velocities. And you'll see with the rapid rotation a slight distortion here. These velocity vectors just show you, this is in density. The color map is in density. You can see the structure. It's not spherical because of the rotation, and that's all included in there. Because of that, the fluxes that are coming out are different along the poles in the equator. At a pole, you see a broader object than at an equator. It looks narrower. And it's the hot region you see that determines the flux. So there's an anisotropy to the heating. You'll also see that this top-bottom asymmetry, this is that perhaps vertical acoustic instability manifesting itself in this rapidly rotating model. But I just wanted to show that basic thing. So this is at different times for the same model. This is just the heating profiles. Again, don't look at it too much detail, but look, you see the hot red and white are where the heating occurs, and with this rapid rotation, you get more heating along the poles. And again, it hadn't been calculated before. These are for just different rotation rates. I want to reasonably fast and slower still. All I want to call your attention to is that there are these plumes, downwelling plumes, and large convective eddies. The number of these plumes is affected by the rotation. And the more rotation, in fact, the more structured these plumes are. If it's very rapid rotation, they go away. But for most rotation rates that are probably viable in this range, low rotation or low rotation, you don't get a significant rotational effect, although you get some. This is very interesting. Now, I want to call your attention to one of the salient features of core collapse, which is that when you collapse and bounce, you get to higher densities and higher temperatures. At those densities and temperatures, the neutrino production rates are huge. But if it's at high densities, those neutrinos can't get anywhere because it's also opaque. However, there's an intermediate region where it's both huge and transparent. And that region is achieved when the shock wave forms, because it heats the material and goes down the density gradient. And behind that shock, you're going to have high temperatures, reasonably high densities, very high rates of production, and in front of that shock, it's semi-transparent. You're going to get this big burst. And so we look versus time at infinity at the luminosity in the various neutrino species. Here's the electron type, which dominates. Here's the mu and the tau type. In fact, that actually dominates at later times. And here's the anti-electron type. So you have to follow these neutrino species independently. You get the electron type, you get collapse, the neutrino flux goes up, it would start going down, then there's a shock breakout. And this is a characteristic signature that we'd like to see in detectors. We see that, we can verify a lot of the basic phenomena that we're discussing here, because that is a characteristic you can't get around in the standard paradigm of core collapse. So if you see that, you can do diagnostic of the entire event. If you don't see that, you have to figure out why.
Quick, Adam, I mean, that the integral of that is a small fraction of the total number.
Yeah, this is just the beginning.
Is it even plausible?
I don't know. To see this?
Yeah.
In super K, it's possible in the galaxy. You'll get about 10 events
in
that spike.
Yeah.
And in the argon 40 detector, Icarus, in its full incarnation, you would see the same number of events. And in the detectors that people are suggesting, like UNO, which would be megaton or half megaton detectors for all sorts of purposes, including proton decay, which would also be very expensive, this would be very, very easy to see, but a factor of 10 even higher. So in the galaxy with the current generation detectors, we see as many events in that spike as we saw from 87A during its entire time. But it's only, to most people, a few events, like 10 events, doesn't seem like much. So, but when I give this talk or something like this to particle physicists, they're happy with, you know, just a few events, and so they don't laugh, and I'm glad you didn't either. So this is the type of burst, this is a 1D calculation. What I'm going to show you are multi-D equivalents to this in a map with a movie. And so, let's see if this is next. No, this is just the spectrum versus time. This is also the spectrum at infinity. That red curve is the spectrum of electron neutrinos, and so you see it rising, that's collapse. And then that burst is the burst that you refer to. This is a log plot. And these other neutrinos are coming up as well. When you get the high temperatures behind the shock, you start producing these other species. Anyway, that's just an example of the spectrum. This is in 2D. Those vectors are flux vectors. And that was the first such calculation in 2D of that burst that was done before in spherical symmetry. This is subsiding away. The colors are entropies. That's the entropy. Yeah, it shows you the character of the convection. So that's that burst, that big burst initially. There's a lot going on. Resolution of the calculation could be better. Core is moving around a little bit. Some interesting stuff. And again, so this is the same thing. You saw that big burst, but instead of the colors being in entropy, that's the energy density of the neutrinos. And that's much more spherical. You saw all this convective motion, but the neutrino flux and the neutrino energy density is much smoother. Matter is very clumpy. Neutrinos integrate over that matter clumpy distribution and give you a much smoother distribution. But this is the first calculation of that effect.
What is 7.8 MeV and then?
This is the 7.8 MeV energy group. So this is done at different energy groups, and this is just at this point, and it's 500 kilometers on the side here. I just like to see the burst. So this is much smoother, but you need to do the radiation transport to see that. This is the same thing, but this is in YE for another model, with rotation, in fact. I just like it because it's much more dramatic, so I'm going to do it again. There's that burst coming in. Neutrinos burst out. Things happen pretty quickly. There's the clock down there. It's in milliseconds. That's just the first 25 milliseconds after bounce. This is interesting. That's the problem I referred to. The codec is off. So that's going to go away. Good. Okay. So this is just bounce, stall, and then you pan back. This is the rapidly rotating one, so you get a significant amount of heating along the poles. That's not an artifact.
These are not velocity vectors.
No, and those are velocity vectors, yes, good. Yeah. The flux vectors are much more radial outwards. Okay, there's a little axis problem here, but that's also exaggerated by the color map. But you see it maintains its basic structure, but look at that. It's now starting to get very asymmetrical. This calculation needs to go further. But we're starting to get this up-down effect, even with the neutrinos on, which is the first time that's been done with the 2D codes. Other people have done 2D calculations. Yanka, for example, has done wonderful 2D calculations, but all his transport has been along spherical rays. He hasn't done the multi-D effects.
Does it start out asymmetric, or it's just noise?
That's a good question. There are perturbations on the grid scale that seed the instability. You're absolutely right. And so the actual development really does depend on those initial conditions, which we really don't know. And that's true in all instability simulations. You can't possibly get that right. Probably not. But the fact that there's this instability that gives you top bottom, not just convection and this sort of thing, which is global behind the shot, is of interest. Now you've seen something like this already. Out of phase again. There we go. Okay. This is a little slightly lower rotation rate, but not insignificant. I just like to show it, so. And get it. I won't give you the finger. See, this thing is going on. It's a graphical problem. We're going to get over it. So this is the type of thing. It's sitting around for a while, and you get some very interesting structures, which are exaggerated by this color map right now for effect. You get a little bit of a polar structure like this. This is a rapidly rotating one. This is an initial omega angular velocity of 1.34 radians per second for a large object. So this is just for your delight. And if you're not delighted, don't tell me. There's a lot of action in there right now, but that's lost. And this one actually exploded.
Something very popular, Fillmore in the 60s.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know what you people are at. I don't want to do that. Okay. This just shows an effect. Unfortunately, the initial zoning in this model was not good, and there is an axis effect here. It goes away a little bit, but that axis effect is something that we want to improve upon. But you'll see what I mean. At later time, because of that axis effect, the initial perturbation structure was such that certain thing happens in a certain way. You'll see what I mean. This is all, these are flux vectors. And you see the flux is pointing in the interior because there's a temperature inversion in the center. It's sort of irrelevant. But those fluxes are coming out, and this is how the fluxes are moving with the matter. You're going to see the whole thing getting redder. That's because the whole thing is getting hotter, higher entropies, and it's about to explode. Stuff falls in and then is blown off. And then it explodes. This is in the inner regions now. Now watch what emerges from the object. There's a wind that comes off.
So both the explosion and the wind is taking place around the equatorial.
That's the anomaly because of the initial. That's the anomaly. If it's rotating, it could do that naturally. But this model, I just wanted to show that wind because that went to 320 milliseconds after bounce. So it's hard to do these calculations. It takes about a month to do each one. So
But...
I wanted to show the...
Is this bipolar? I mean, that's...
Yes, but that's with the rapidly rotating case.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry to... I'm just trying to show you again a range of possibilities. The wind is something we saw in the mid-90s, in calculations that I published in the mid-90s. And that was quite interesting as well, and it seems to be generic. You can't see it in a Lagrangian code so easily, but in a Eulerian code you do, and I'm not going to go into that. But the physically, you'd expect exactly that. You get an explosion, and after the explosion, the pressures go down sufficiently, you leave behind an object that has an atmosphere, that has neutrino radiation, and you ask the question, is that unstable to the formation of a wind? Just by neutrino heating, it goes back to the old Parker wind solution. If people know about the Parker wind from the solar wind model, which wasn't true, but it was informative.
This is the old Zurich-Shapiro
saltmeter
wind.
Right? Yeah, that was in spherical symmetry, although, we simulated it.
That's good. But I mean,
it's similar to that. And in the context of supernovae, you always seem to get this wind that follows. Now, what the consequences are, we don't know. It was hoped, and Todd Thompson did part of his thesis on this, that wind was the seed of the R process. We can't get the right parameters so far for the R process in that wind. But hydrodynamically, you get an explosion that constitutes mostly energy and most of the mass, but then what follows is a wind. You look at if you look at Cass A, people are making a big deal out of this megasecond integration of Chandra, the X-ray observatory of the supernova remnant, and they see this bipolar structure. Okay, but it's pointing in the wrong direction from my perspective. If you look where all the mass is and all the energy, it's perpendicular to that bipolar structure. That's where the explosion is. And if you had a rapidly rotating object, you get an explosion like those earlier movies I showed you. And then, how does the wind that emerges after that look? You have to have multi-D effects. It could be some interesting rotational effects. It could be some interesting magnetic effects. But that other bipolar structure in Cass A, which doesn't have much energy, is very dilute. Might be this wind. But now it's punching its way through the supernova debris. The supernova debris is clearing out the region into which this wind can now flow. It's not flowing in the same direction, though. And so that has to be figured out. But there may be these two explosions in the supernova, 100 times less energetic. Now, if the MHD effects are important, and it's very rapidly rotating, it's possible that at low rotation rates, you get an MHD modified wind that gives you some sort of polarity, but at low powers. But if the rotation rate is large, it might overcome in power the power of the neutrino-driven mechanism. And so there may be a large rotation rates where, in fact, the MHD takes over and you get hypernovae, and perhaps gamma ray bursts. And at the low rotation rates, the MHD isn't so important, and the neutrino mechanism does what it does. And a hint of that in regular supernovae may be this weak secondary explosion that in Cass A seems to have put together an interesting structure, but it's not energetically important, and maybe a hint. Anyway, that's speculative, obviously. Now, as I said, there's rotation. I want to emphasize the following in the time remaining. These are calculations done by Ott et al. We were interested in the gravitational radiation signatures, and we're going to continue to do these things, in particular support of LIGO efforts. But if you start out with an initial rotational profile like this, this is the angular velocity in radians per second at 10. This is 1 second periods, things like these are fast. And this is slower. And you can get down here. If you have something like this, these map into structures like this. Collapse naturally amplifies the spin rates by about a factor of 1,000. If the spin rate is really rapid, the amplification factor is smaller because you get a centrifugal bounce. If it's not so rapid, the amplification is still about that factor of 1,000. We don't know what these are. But you get things like this where you can have final rotational periods that are on the order of milliseconds to 10 milliseconds. Naturally, and we're writing a paper on this stuff now. Christian Ott, Rolf Wolder, and I. Anyway. With this mapping from initial to final, you also get all this convection and you get these oblate structures, time-changing quadrupole moments. And so here's the angular velocities versus maps. The colors are angular velocities. You can see the barrel structure. It looks like a cylindrical structure, but this is an aside. Okay. Before I get to the gravitational radiation, I wanted to show you what might happen in 3D. This is without neutrinos, but this is Shang Li U myself, well, Fahmy Ou, Christian Ott, Joel Tolin, and myself, doing 3D simulations of these very rapidly rotating disks with a realistic equation of state but no neutrino physics. The point here is that if it's rotating rapidly enough, you can't do it in 2D, you have to do it in 3D because you get instabilities. And in fact, in these calculations, you get so-called M equals 1 spiral arm instabilities, one-arm bandits. And those will give you, because they're accompanied by quadrupole oscillations, a significant gravitational radiation. And so this just gives you a sense of what it looks like, I think. There you go. The collapse and bounce, you'll get the basic idea. You see these waves coming off and these structures forming, and those will give off a lot of gravitational radiation. The important thing about this, from my perspective, is under these circumstances, when you include 3D, with all the gravitational torques and the waves that are produced, that you have a mechanism without viscosity for getting rid of angular velocity. You can slow them down. You can get rid of the high rotation rates that I talked about before, leaving behind a few millisecond periods, and perhaps cut it down by factors of 5 or so. The viscosity that I referred to that Todd and myself and Elliot Quater did, you see this structure that's forming? And then it's going to smooth itself out, but that's going to be a whopping source of gravitational radiation. Those calculations also had, of course, not only energy deposition, but angular momentum transport, because there was a viscosity. Viscosity gives you angular momentum transport, and so it can slow down a core. And in those calculations, we lost 90% of the angular velocity in 500 milliseconds, approximately. So you do have this type of viscosity that is important for the supernova. It also slows it down in the right way, and leaves behind neutron stars that are more canonical. Okay, so now to gravitational radiation. Very quickly, you can calculate the gravitational radiation spectra from these systems, and this is the integrated spectrum. This is, you do the Fourier analysis of the strains coming off, and you get. This is frequency, where this is 500 hertz, 1,000 hertz, etc. These types of spectra. I just want to show you the range. These are different rotation rates. If it's rotating very fast, it bounces at low densities and gives you low frequency stuff. Not high frequency stuff. So high rotation rate gives you low frequency stuff. And that's this type of purple curve. If it's rotating really slowly, there's an optimal rotation rate which will give you optimal gravitational radiation. Because if it's rotating fast, it bounces at low densities. If it's rotating slowly, then you don't get any gravitational radiation except due to the convection, which is still significant, but the rotation really helps. So there's an optimal rotational profile. Importantly, by looking at the spectrum of the emission and where the peak is, you can figure out the rotation rate. Okay?
Radiates more power. It looks like the beta equals 0.2 has more power.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, total integrated energy radiated. Yeah.
So the slower rotator has more power.
The slower rotator has more power, yeah. But if it's really slow, there's a peak, and this is near the peak. If you made beta, this is the T over W in percent. So if you made beta 0.05, 0.001, then it's lower. So there's an optimal value. And so in the rapidly rotating regime, the slowest rotating ones are that give more gravitational radiation.
What's going on in the high frequencies?
They're harmonics.
Yeah, what do you mean?
It's not so simple. You're always going to get harmonic structures in these sorts of things if you don't have pure tones. And so what we have is these convective motions and these oscillation frequencies. And so you're going to get not only the fundamental, but the higher harmonics just as because you don't have pure tones, and you're going to do a Fourier analysis of that. So you're going to get those higher harmonics. So this in fact is a harmonic of this. Up here, you're starting to get a little aliasing, so I'm not going to push this too hard. And this is just a synopsis compared to advanced LIGO sensitivity and the initial LIGO. Initial LIGO is getting close to being real. They're actually almost at their design specs, and they're going to get the money for the next generation. And the next generation will be this, and this is just the RMS strain. It's the optimal orientation of the rotation axis. For detection, so there's a little push here. But these dots are basically the RMS values for those spectra that I showed before. And you can see the range of signals. This is at 10 kiloparsecs. So it's in the galaxy. But even the initial LIGO could in principle see the whole range, almost the whole range of models that are rotating now at 10 kiloparsecs. The galaxy is 50 kiloparsecs or whatever, depending on how you want to define it, wide. So you have to go down by the square of the distance. But this is rather promising. And this also gives you an idea of the spectra. I just repositioned those spectra to give you an idea where the peaks are. So the peak of the flux is at these frequencies, and the RMS is at this value. So you can see there's a systematic trend for all the rotating models. If you don't have rotation, you have these over here. Well, that's due to the convection. You still get gravitational radiation. We published this stuff in 96. Not these models, but this type of thing. And it's still above the advanced LIGO sensitivity curve, which peaks at around 100 hertz. LISO would be way over here. Now, one thing these calculations didn't include is the gravitational radiation off the neutrinos. There's so much mass energy in the neutrinos. If there's an anisotropy in the mass energy ejected through the neutrinos, you get a time-changing quadrupole moment. And that will give you a spectrum something like this, which we published, I hate to say, I didn't put it down here, in 96. And this is just the spectrum versus Earth. And what you get is you put a lot of power at low frequencies. Now, LIGO doesn't see much beyond here. And we don't know how this extends into the LISO band, which might start at a tenth hertz or a hertz or something like that, depending on how you take it, tenth of a hertz, which would be space interferometry. But it's possible that the anisotropy of the neutrino emission in some models is sufficiently large that it could dominate in various ranges of frequency the gravitational radiation signature.
Well, low frequency is the DC offset.
Right. Yeah, that's very possible. Right. It's almost exactly a DC offset in the limit, but it depends on where that limit is. So the inverse, how much is it close to the DC offset when you are at 0.1 hertz or at 1 hertz? That type of thing. It also has to do with memory.
Yeah,
gravitational memory. Right. Okay.
So it's just a few minutes
now? Thank you, Lars. Yes. Wrapping up with the last things. I just wanted to give a final word on this new scheme that we want to use that should go beyond the calculations that you saw. And this is in collaboration with Yvonne Hubany, in red at the bottom. And what we're trying to do is to go to the next generation of multi-D radiation hydrodynamic code. And that involves actually doing the calculations in the laboratory frame. Again, this is for knowledgeable people. Most of these calculations are generally done in the co-moving frame, where you're in the matter frame. And all the opacities are sort of simple. It's as if you're not moving at all. There's a number of simplifications. Anyway, if you do this in the laboratory frame, and we define these quantities, like the opacities, absorption, emission, this sort of thing, in the co-moving frame, we can do a Lorentz transformation between those two frames, staying in the laboratory frame, and thereby introduce V over C terms. And we can do everything to order V over C, including anisotropic scattering. We can also put together the zeroth and first moment equations, the energy equation and the flux equation. If we have a closure, we can do that. But we've put together the basic equations for 2.5D cylindrical and spherical coordinate calculations, where 2.5D means we can include rotation and include the flux in the phi direction. It's just as roughly symmetric. So it's 2D, but it includes that extra flux. And so there's a lot of bells and whistles in this. It will be implicit transport, of course. It automatically includes any neutrino viscosity effects there may be. Now, that's again, a technical thing, but this is one of the few contexts where the following may be true. In astrophysics and in most of terrestrial physics, Reynolds numbers are really high in large-scale stuff. And if you want to simulate that turbulence in all its complexity, you have to go through what's called a large inertial range, all the way down to the viscous scale. The viscous scale in this context, almost uniquely, is fairly large because of the neutrinos. That's never before been simulated. And it will come as a matter of course out of this formalism because it will include the velocity-dependent terms and the neutrino transport into 2.5D. And it's the case that the viscosity is such that the smallest scales may be a kilometer or a few tenths of a kilometer. And we may be able to simulate on one computer without any subgrid scales or anything like that the entire inertial range. And we can't do that in any other astrophysical problem. That doesn't mean it's going to be the case for all radii. On the inside, it's not going to be true, but it doesn't make any difference. On the outside, it's not going to be true, but it doesn't make a difference there either. But in the crucial intermediate regions, we might get everything right. That's something to be hoped for. There are techniques, and Yvonne doesn't want me to show you this, so I'll go through this quickly. and wonderful equations, which I glory at looking at, and you may not. And so I conclude, what is the future? The future is always more complicated. But you can see the tools are evolving, however slowly, to actually simulate nature in all its glory and detail. We've been doing 1D, and we've more or less mastered the 1D stuff. The work that we've done, this is with Todd Thompson, in 1D, Liebendorfer et al., Janka has really sort of nailed that problem given the input physics. We think we have all the basic physics. 2D is still open, and we've shown you some of the first explorations. And the types of things might involve, again, neutrino viscosity, anisotropic fluxes, these multidimensional hydrodynamic effects that increase the efficiency of neutrino deposition, this vertical acoustic instability that might be associated with kicks. It might also be associated with the mechanism. It may be just a little bit extra necessary because it seems to be helping in the explosions, but I can get to that later. Magnetic fields may be important, so we would have to do MHD eventually, and general relativity to include. Now, I don't mention those things just to say how important this problem is and how difficult it is and how wonderful we are. It's just that nature has provided us with a problem where everything is could be important in various limits. And it's a very, very rich problem whose general solution is going to take a little time, but for which the general solution is really visible. I think that we're very close to understanding this in some detail. But what would it take for us to know that we've gotten it right? But what it would take would be the reproduction of the supernova explosion energies. We observe explosion energies, we want to be able to reproduce that. What it would take would be the understanding of the pulsar kick mechanism and the distribution of pulsar kicks. Why low velocities, why high velocities, and where. What it would take would be understanding the mass of the neutron star left behind in detail. What it would take would be the nucleosynthesis, which is a great signature because what we're ejecting are a lot of heavy elements. Well, there's still a symmetric matter and not very neutron-rich, but we still want to explain all that in some detail. And so, there, as I close, I also want to mention that, of course, there may be this gamma-ray burst supernova connection. And there are a lot of indications of that, and that's a whole talk in and of itself. But when we understand, when we can make these connections that I referred to before, we'll finally believe that we understand what's going on. And I can see that in the future, but we're not quite there yet. And thank you very much for your patience.